Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and good afternoon to everyone. Yes, my name is Aleksandra Gliszczyńska-Grabiaz, but as we discussed, Alexandra from Poland is a kind of my nickname within all those who deal with fighting anti-Semitism, because it's not that common that someone coming from Poland and having a legal background gets involved into fighting anti-Semitism, mostly with the use of law. But not only, because I think that fighting anti-Semitism is a challenge that needs to be tackled from as many perspectives as possible. But today I will talk to you about fighting anti-Semitism with the use of human rights law instruments, or perhaps more about the new way or the new attempts of some of the circles, some of the actors, international actors that actually try to counteract this trend of using international law against anti-Semitism, sometimes even inciting anti-Semitism through the use or abuse of international law. So the title of my presentation and the very topic of this protecting human rights and fighting anti-Semitism, if they go hand in hand, comes as my conclusion or my consideration of the trend that I have noticed, that this mostly visible for the has been mostly visible for the last couple of years, where the human rights agenda stopped being considered as also the agenda of fighting anti-Semitism. And all these that are trying to put anti-Semitism within human rights law, and rightfully so, are being sometimes even attacked for doing so. So I would like to present today some of my conclusions, some of my doubts concerning this, what's happening within the discussions about international human rights law in the context of fighting anti-Semitism. And then, of course, we can discuss the particular issues or questions you may have. So I will move now to some basic facts that actually should be, to my mind, reminded all over again, and in particular to all those who claim that anti-Semitism shouldn't be considered as an issue within international human rights law. So, I consider myself, and not only me, of course, so anti-Semitism should be considered as perhaps the most ancient and persistent manifestation of human rights violations. And these are multiple human rights violations. So this is not just one violation, but it concerns various human rights and freedoms. What's crucially important is the fact that the fight against anti-Semitism has given wings to the international human rights movement in the 20th century. We have to remember that all the systems in the terms of treaties and laws and binding regulations, international regulations, but also domestic national laws and other regulations, they have a lot to do with the fight against anti-Semitism and with the very rise of the systems of human rights protection that started after the Second World War and should be considered as a kind of a response towards the crimes committed during World War II and Holocaust in particular. However, as I put it here, both in the ages of faith and in the ages of reason, law was used not for the protection against anti-Semitism, but actually as an instrument of inciting anti-Semitism in all possible dimensions and ways. So it's and then in 20th century, anti-Semitism was actually prescribed in law of so many countries all over the world. And was the law was used as an instrument of oppression against the Jews with the Nuremberg laws of 1935, serving as the most drastic example of how the law was used and abused in order to persecute Jews. But yes, okay. But then we had again the Second World War, and then the systems, international systems of human rights protection emerged. And this is a beautiful quotation from Kofi Annan from 2004, when he spoke about this, and he said that the name United Nations was coined to describe the alliance fighting to end that barbarous regime, and our organization came into being when the world had just learned the full horror of the concentration and extermination camps. Again, here the very important sentence: human rights agenda that fails to address anti-Semitism denies its own history. As we will see, and as you all very well know, the United Nations as an organization, and particular member states of this organization, they definitely do not remember about this call of Kofi Annan and about the origins of the creation of the United Nations. But the same tendency and the same narratives concerning the emergence of international human rights law was expressed by the former Council of Europe Deputy Secretary General, stressing the fact that the Council of Europe emerged from the ashes of the Holocaust. And as I will claim later, I will try to show some examples of it. If we talk today about the system, international human rights protection system, that really cares about fighting anti-Semitism, then it definitely turned from UN into Council of Europe and the European system of human rights protection, also including the European Union as such. And if I see any hope in still keeping anti-Semitism as a human rights agenda issue, then I would definitely rather look at Europe than the UN, which is sad, of course. How come that UN turned from the protector of Jews, and also in its treaties, in the, for example, International Convention on against all forms of racial discrimination, into the forum of spreading anti-Semitism? And of course, it doesn't mean that all bodies or special procedures of UN spread anti-Semitism. Of course not. But for sure, these bodies that are that are created by the member states and are more of political character, they have been captured, I would say, by anti-Semitic propaganda and agenda to the large extent. One of the turning points in allowing anti-Semitism into UN was the infamous Durban Conference of 2001, of course, and I'm sure you all know what happened there, and the implications and consequences of Durban 1, of the initial conference, are still being noticed. So the fact that so many states withdrawn from participating in this year's anniversary conference is a meaningful fact, but of course this what happened at that time brought enormously negative consequences in seeing or considering anti-Semitism as an issue within human rights, UN human rights agenda. So for me, in Durban in 2001, something extremely negative happened, and I think that a lot of those who want to spread anti-Semitism were given green light to do so within UN and beyond. So the effect of this is the fact that today we have, as I put it here on this slide, we have UN shameful statistics. This one is borrowed from UN Watch, which does amazing job in monitoring this what happens in UN. So these are the numbers of General Assembly resolutions directed against Israel, starting from 2015 I think it was up until 2019 this study was conducted. So as you can see, 112 resolutions of the General Assembly of the UN against Israel, in comparison to 5 concerning Iran, 6 concerning North Korea, 8 concerning Syria. Just to remind you, of course, it's needless to say, but this was still the time of the bloody conflict taking place there. United States 7, China 0. Perhaps, yes, these zeros are most telling examples. Qatar 0, Turkey 0, Zimbabwe 0, Venezuela 0. And Israel 112. And this is, of course, the same with the UN Human Rights Council and also other mechanisms of human rights protection within this political part of UN system, because we have also the other system, or the second part of the system called the treaty bodies system, and there the situation is much better. But still the most visible and decisive part is this a political part of the UN human rights protection system, including the General Assembly. So this what happened in 2019 then should be considered as really a kind of a miracle, because there was the report of UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion or Belief released. And here for the very first time, so this report is being considered as historic in the context of fighting anti-Semitism, I would say that anti-Semitism was called by its true name in this report. So very courageously, Dr. Shahid actually expressed everything that we, I mean the people who are involved in fighting anti-Semitism, in researching anti-Semitism, have known for years. But it was not acknowledged by the UN. So here are the examples of some of the conclusions from the report. One of the top questions is what effect, what consequences has this report brought so far? I think we cannot assess it fully, but the very fact that such report was issued and published is a meaningful one. But again, this is just a singular example of a courageous position of one individual holding the mandate of UN Special Rapporteur. But there is still much more to do to actually stop those who want to take back anti-Semitism from human rights agenda. But still, it needs to be noted that such a report also exists, that this is not only the criticism of UN, but there are also some positive actions to be named here in this regard. So, yes, so I will get now to the BDS, because it's a very particular example of how anti-Semitism is being by some named as a mean of fighting for human rights of Palestinians. I put it here in this way, calling it a rather illusory or cynical claim of protecting Palestinians' human rights, because I cannot really see in what terms, under what conditions, BDS actions can really improve the human rights situation of Palestinians. And this is also very important to stress that, and it's also the responsibility of every human rights lawyer, and I belong to this category, that every time when Palestinians' rights, human rights are being violated, there needs to be consequences. And those who are responsible for these violations, in accordance to the international law, should be held responsible in the terms of law, of international law. But at the same time, I consider BDS as actually a way of breaching human rights and freedoms of persons, as I put it here, not only associated with or connected to the state of Israel in real, but also all persons with Jewish background in the sense of their national, ethnic, or religious origin. From my research, I can conclude that the results of BDS include the experience of discrimination, persecution, exclusion, and intimidation by the Jewish people and those who are considered as such. I name here just a few examples of such violations. So personal dignity, safety, freedom of expression, assembly, association, etc., etc. Because we still need to remember that BDS doesn't concern only goods or other aspects of life, but BDS concerns also individuals and their activities. Implementing BDS practices against, for example, Jewish scholars is for me an obvious act of discrimination forbidden by international human rights law and should be considered as such. If it is, it depends on the national laws of particular states where such acts take place, but in the sense of international human rights law perspective, it's as I said, an obvious case that BDS is a violation of human rights. So I will get now to this exactly what I said at the beginning, to the European perspective of looking at anti-Semitism as a human rights violation. But here I'll start with the BDS as a special case, because in 2009 there was a first judgment of the European Court of Human Rights concerning BDS. The case was against France, in Willem versus France. So here we had a mayor of a municipality who called for the boycott of Israeli products within the municipality. And this was considered by the European Court of Human Rights as a discriminatory act. So Mr. Willem, who applied to the European Court of Human Rights because he was punished for his behavior in France, and before the European Court of Human Rights, he claimed that his freedom of speech was violated. So here the European Court of Human Rights said that his rights were not violated, as this what he did, the act of calling for the boycott of Israeli products, was actually the incitement to discrimination. But then in 2020, a European Court of Human Rights again dealt with the BDS, and here it decided in a different way. Here, perhaps because this was the application of ordinary citizens who were the BDS activists, and they were again punished in France for their actions. Here, the court stressed the fact that through their actions, they wanted to trigger or stimulate debate among supermarket consumers, customers, and this is why their act was not of the same importance, so to say, as the act of the mayor of a municipality. So here the court said that the rights of the applicants in Baldassi case were violated. So we have two different approaches towards the BDS actions. I think we cannot say so far which narratives will prevail in the future when the court will consider similar cases. But this is important to note, that these issues are being under the consideration of the European Court of Human Rights. But more generally, and I wanted to praise the European Court of Human Rights here, there is a rich case law on anti-Semitic hate speech and Holocaust denial of the court. And in none of such cases, the rights of, for example, anti-Semites who claimed that they were punished for their words, for their anti-Semitism, and then they claimed before the European Court that their rights, that the free speech rights were violated. So in none of these cases, the European Court of Human Rights had ever said that their freedom of speech was violated. Every time the court stresses that fighting anti-Semitism also with the rule of with the instruments of law is an international obligation of the member states of the Council of Europe. And that spreading anti-Semitism is not a form of free expression, but this is just incitement to or spreading hatred. And as such, it is not being protected. The same applies to Holocaust denial, of course, which is considered by the European Court of Human Rights as an abuse of free speech. I'm fully aware that for the US audience listening to me today, it can sound really strange, but in Europe we have completely different attitude, legal attitude towards free speech, and there are far-reaching limitations to free speech, to hateful speech. And we can, of course, discuss the differences and which system works better, if the First Amendment law is more useful towards hateful speech, or the European attitude is better for example, anti-Semitism prevention. But this is the fact that under European law, anti-Semitic hate speech is being punished, and the European Court of Human Rights confirms that this is being done rightfully so. So just one example, one of the latest examples concerning the case that involved anti-Semitism. Here, the Bulgarian nationals of Jewish ethnic origin, they complained that their national law, or the way the law was implemented in their case, didn't protect them properly from experiencing anti-Semitism that was spread by one of the politicians and journalists. And here the court confirmed that that the courts, national courts, had failed in their positive obligation to ensure respect for the applicant's private life. So here the protection against anti-Semitism was included into the notion or category of private life. So this is also why I consider the European system more protective towards the victims of anti-Semitism. And in Europe, there is still this narrative that says that actually fighting anti-Semitism is a very important component of European law. So just a few more examples of how are the latest developments in Europe. And I really hope that these strategies and these instruments will be fully implemented, because the most important thing when it comes to law, it's not laws or bills or provisions put on paper, but their real life and everyday life implementation by the law enforcement, by the courts, etc., etc. So we have the first ever EU strategy on combating anti-Semitism and fostering Jewish life. So this is almost the strategy planned for almost 10 years. First ever strategy of this kind adopted by the European Commission just some weeks ago. And I know that there are plans to implement it in every single member state. We'll see how it works. And I hope to be involved in the implementation by Poland of some of the elements of this strategy. I think it has great potential, but again, it all depends on member states, how they will treat this strategy, how seriously they will take it. Then we have a new general recommendation on anti-Semitism adopted by the European Commission against racism and intolerance. So the first strategy is the strategy of the European Union. Here we have a strategy of the Council of Europe, also implemented this year. So it's another tool of strengthening the narratives and the efforts to fight anti-Semitism in Europe, in the member states of the Council of Europe. And of course, we have the IRAS working definition of anti-Semitism, and more different actors, entities in Europe implement, adopt and implement this working definition. And the controversies that arose around this definition, mostly in US, are not that present or that visible in Europe, I would say, even though some states, some actors raise doubts as to the need to implement this definition, or the doubts concerning some of the parts of this definition, mostly dealing with the with the issue of anti-Israeli hatred. But these are the examples of how Europe is tackling anti-Semitism today. So perhaps they do not prove my hypothesis that anti-Semitism is pushed back from this human rights agenda. But I think that this is a general impression when we talk about the UN and perhaps US as well. As a country, but still in Europe, I think there is a lot of potential to keep anti-Semitism within this agenda and consider it still as a human rights issue. So some conclusions, conclusions, I put it here in a different way. So searching for answers, searching for solutions. So the answers to the question of why we turned into this direction of pushing back anti-Semitism from human rights agenda. So these are some of my ideas of why it looks this way, why it happens this way. But searching for solutions, I put here in the first place the public interest strategic litigation at national and international level, because as a lawyer, I truly believe in the power of litigation and, so to say, going to court to fight in the name of the victims of anti-Semitism. But to do this, we also need different kinds of resources, and it's not that easy. But I still consider law here and litigation as a very useful tool of advancing our cause. So yes, strengthening the European legal perspective. I think it should be the one that should play the role of a role model for others. So whenever we can, we should stress the way the European legal system, international human rights protection system works in Europe, and actually that the solutions and the case law of the European Court of Human Rights should serve as a very positive example here. Yes, and bringing back the true story of human rights protection, its origins, so that it all started with the need to fight anti-Semitism that led to Auschwitz, to Holocaust. Sadly, but we still need to remind everyone about this fact. And finding new allies, I think it's especially important for the Jewish community to look for new allies, because I have noticed it, for example, on various conferences all around the world that with the topic of fighting anti-Semitism, that most of the speakers, most of the involved are Jews and also Israelis. And of course, it's natural, and I understand this. But without the broader environment of allies, also coming from different nations, different perspectives, different origins, I think it's incredibly difficult to do what we actually have to do. So I think it's crucially important to try to engage others as well in fighting anti-Semitism. Investing in research on anti-Semitism, this is very important, and I think it has been neglected for the last years to some extent, in particular in legal studies, that's for sure. But this is also our, I think, personal scholars' responsibility to deal with this issue. And to get involved not only within the activism, but also research and scholarly activities. And I think I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much for all of that and for your, you know, thorough explanation about the legalities. We have seen, obviously, that, you know, we are making some stride in the legal sphere, which is obviously critical to our debate, to our battle all around. And obviously, mm-hmm. the debate here in North America that we're seeing is, of course, the enforcement as it relates to the IRA definition. So there's obviously a lot mm-hmm. to discuss. With that being said, the floor is now open. And of course, you know, as I said before, if you have questions, please type them in or raise your virtual hand, and we could go from there. Alex, do you want to start us off with the first question?
Sure. Thanks very much for a really terrific presentation and a summary of where we are. And I think the European perspective, the European scene, is something that most North Americans aren't aware of the way they should be. There are some of us who follow these things to an extent as they relate to anti-Semitism and BDS in particular, but I think it's very important to get the broader picture out there. I have lots and lots of comments and questions. And I don't want to seem too cynical, although I am, which is not a reflection on you, but a kind of a reflection of my own experiences. So let me ask you, these the kinds of top-down approaches that you've noted by the Council of Europe and the European Commission, let's call them Philo-Semitic strategies. How do these then get implemented at the national level? Because it's at the national level that most BDS activism takes place. Most actual, real anti-Semitism gets experienced or inflicted. Mm-hmm. And is this realistic to do it from the top down rather than from the bottom up?
I would say that it all depends from national legislator and then the law enforcement. Because of course the EU or the Council of Europe can coordinate, can implement such strategies, etc. But these are not the instruments, legal instruments of this kind that would, in case of non-implementation, would cause any drastic effects against the member states, so to say. The member states are obliged to implement these strategies, but more in a political sense than in legal sense. There are no sanctions for not implementing these policies. Still, there are, of course, sanctions for not implementing the treaty provisions, EU treaties or Council of Europe provisions concerning non-discrimination. So it's crucially important that member states, particular member states, individual member states, consider BDS actions as discriminatory acts. If this is the fact, then it's much easier to tackle BDS actions with the use of binding law, both national and European law. So of course, we should treat these strategies also in the symbolic sense of the showing of the attitude of these organizations towards the problem, the issue of anti-Semitism. But as long as, for example, national courts will not consider particular BDS actions as discriminatory or as hateful, then it's true we cannot do much about this.
Alex, follow up or you're good?
Well, I think Alexandra kind of indicated the answer that I was thinking, that these kinds of imperial, and let's call it for what it is, it's an imperial, these are imperial edicts. Again, a cynical American perspective, imposed on national structures, and the imperial center in Brussels can't even get the local authorities to spend what they're supposed to be spending according to various EU guidelines. So I express my skepticism, and I'll be very interested to hear what our other listeners have to say.
I just wanted to stress that still there is a European Court of Human Rights, which is then, you know, the judgments are they're really meaningful in the terms of the states, if the state is not implementing its obligations, human rights obligations, properly in accordance with the European Convention of Human Rights, then there are also financial penalties for the states. So this is a useful instrument and the real one, right, with real consequences. But when it comes to the strategies, there are more of the advisory character. But there are states who take this seriously, and a lot of it is being done, Germany being such an example. But of course, the political pressure needs to be really strong in order to have the effect that we are hope for. So yes, being cynical is rightful here.
All good, great. So I'm gonna go to the audience, if that's okay, Alex. So let's take Richard Fulton has a question here, and let me see if I can connect Richard. Richard, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead. Ask your question.
I have actually. Thank you very much for your presentation. I actually have two questions, which are pretty much unrelated. I'll ask the first question, and with the permission of the moderator, I'll ask the second one. So the first question is, you talked about BDS as a human rights violation. I wonder if you could address the specific situation that has gotten a lot of attention in the United States, perhaps too much, about Ben and Jerry's announcement it would not sell its goods in the territories. Ostensibly going to continue to do so within, you know, Israel proper. Could you analyze that in terms of your vision of BDS as a human rights violation? That is there any difference between a boycott that's directed at activity relating to the settlements versus activity directed at Israel as a whole?
Mm-hmm. What's your second, Richard? So we'll try to combine both.
My second question is, there's been a movement underway to have the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council step back from use of the veto in cases involving genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, et cetera, atrocity crimes. Many of us, of course, are very concerned that Russia and China have seen fit to use the veto to prevent sanctions against and steps being taken vis-a-vis human rights violations in Myanmar and Syria and other places as well. And yet at the same time, there's a concern that many of us have that when it comes to Israel, where the United Nations has so often been an unbiased and unbalanced interlocutor, that protection of preventing the UN from misusing resolutions to Israel, that might be weakened, where those steps to be taken vis-a-vis the veto. So I wonder if you've been mm-hmm. through that, and whether you could comment on the initiative to reduce greatly, if not eliminate, the use of veto by Security Council members in those kinds of situations.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Starting perhaps from the second one, I don't know what are the procedural requirements for actually dealing with the veto rights of the members of the Security Council, but most definitely this will be all considered as a political matter, not a purely legal matter, I'm afraid. The history of Security Council vetoes, etc., it purely manifests that and clearly manifests that the veto is being used as a political tool or sword even in the fights of interests and other aspects of political character. I think but still the composition of the Security Council gives some hope as to these attempts of even further abusing the construction of the veto right of the members of the Security Council, but I haven't really heard about this and I haven't get involved into the discussions concerning this issue. So I can only say from the you know, from my general knowledge on the history of using the vetoes or the threats of using the vetoes by the Security Council members. And when it comes to the BDS, of course, there is there is a difference between the BDS methods or using BDS against the state as such, and also in this economic sense or business sense, and when BDS is directed against individuals, because human rights law concerns human rights and freedoms, and these of individual character mostly, but also of the groups of individuals, and they are being protected by international law, mostly because of their belonging to the members of the groups belonging to particular, again, groups of ethnic, religious, national origin or race. When I deal with the BDS, I do mostly with the BDS actions concerning individuals. But we can always say that even if the BDS is aimed at affecting the state as such, then it affects also the individuals that are nationals of this state. And in the case of BDS, there is always this ethnic element of BDS that has to be taken into consideration. So I think that with Ben and Jerry, I read only and I stopped there, even though I know that the Lawfare Project in particular takes care of the case in the legal dimension. But I read the New York Times the letter and I think it was the title of the article was "We Are Ben and Jerry," and this was written by the owners of the company, and from what I read there, they completely misunderstood the very sense and consequences of the actions of boycott that they actually agreed on. So here in the legal terms, it's must also much more complicated when it comes to such actions of boycott than when it comes to the actions of boycotting people, like for example Israeli scholars. So that would be my answer.
Great, thank you. I'm going to move on to Charles's question, Charles Feynman, and moving on to the French situation, and he's referring to the situation that happened with the Halimi murder, where the case there was the conclusion that the anti-Semitic murderer was not responsible because he was under the influence as far as drugs. You want to comment a little bit about that and maybe talk about French courts and rulings on that. That's been getting a lot of press as a result of how that played out.
Mm-hmm. Well, this ruling is highly controversial, of course. I think it doesn't really tackle the issue because of perhaps some concerns when it comes to the general attitude towards anti-Semitism in France, which is of particular character, and I'm sure you all know about this, that anti-Semitism in France is on the rise. Still, I believe that the courts in France are still independent, and their assessment of the case was based on perhaps some facts that we do not know. But at the same time, some of the most important judgments of the European Court of Human Rights concerned France. And a lot of anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers were seeking for the protection of the European Court of Human Rights against the judgments that were directed against them by the French courts. So I would still claim that French courts and French laws are there to protect Jewish people. But at the same time, I know that social tensions there influence the general attitude towards not only Jews but also the issue of anti-Semitism. So, when it comes to the French law, it meets fully all the requirements by the international human rights law. They have legislation concerning anti-Semitic hate speech and hate crime. They have proper legislation concerning Holocaust denial and negationism. So it's, again, the matter of implementation. And I have the impression that up until perhaps recently, the implementation of this law was rather a good one, a positive example by the French courts.
Great, thank you. Let me shift gears in a question that I had in mind, especially related to the latest ruling that came out of Israel regarding NGOs and human rights, you know, and their ties to terrorism. We know that there, you know, obviously that the facade and the use of human rights organizations and their ties to terrorism is something that is growing and is pervasive and has always been within the DNA of some of these organizations. Are you seeing that legally getting traction in Europe, making the case that, again, if we are going to fight terrorism, you know, and by extension fighting anti-Semitism, is that something that we're seeing being helpful in the European courts, or the fact that they are connected to Palestinian causes, they're being dismissed as a result of the human rights facade that plays into all of this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I still have trust in European courts that every case of such ties that link NGOs and terrorism would be addressed and then tackled in front of before the European courts, also member states courts. And I think it's still much easier to deal with in the litigation sense with such cases than it is in US. So perhaps there should be a kind of strategic litigation initiated in one of the cases. There are good cases and obvious examples of such ties, and then to try to prove this in the courts. And I think that this would really bring a kind of a game changer effect if there were binding judgments dealing with this kind of connections and ties and manifesting, proving how dangerous they are. I think that still this attempt to abuse human rights to actually hide true intentions and connections would be dismissed by the courts in Europe. This is my impression. But of course, it all depends on particular case, and also the fact who would be the victims or the potential victims of the activities of such organizations, and the outcomes of the activities of such organizations. So it could be an extremely interesting and complex case to be litigated in front of the European courts.
Great, thank you. So as a segue to that, our member of the audience, Gary Astower, is asking, what is your thoughts really on groups like Human Rights Watch and how they've been involved in this space, given their nefarious activities and how they operate? If you want to comment on their acts as well in Europe and maybe also in the United States, if you have knowledge of that as well.
I think that you are much better equipped and ready to address this question, as Human Rights Watch is an American NGO. But of course, some of their statements or actions, I have the feeling are trying to show this the perspective the perspective of both sides, and sometimes it's impossible to do, because when we deal with some kind of particular human rights violations, and there is just one side responsible for what's going on, what's happening, then it should be said clearly and openly. So I don't know the actions of the Human Rights Watch well enough to really comment on their behavior towards the issue of anti-Semitism. I will leave it here. I'm sorry I cannot be more helpful with answering this one. But I think that as one of the largest, biggest, most important NGOs in the world, they should really bear and have the and have this responsibility of for what they are saying and what they are doing. And I hope they feel it this way.
All right, good. No, obviously it's a longer conversation, but thank you for that. Let me jump to our friend Andrea in Canada. Who is going back to your comments on BDS, is asking, given that the ultimate goals of BDS, as she writes, is correctly the destruction of the state of Israel, if you could talk a little bit, how and why it's being tolerated in European circles and the way it's perceived, the distinction between, is BDS seen as 100% anti-Semitic or not, and how that plays into the European scene. Obviously, I can comment about the American scene, but we'd like to hear your perspective on the European side of things. Yeah.
I think that there is not that much awareness of the goal that you just mentioned of the BDS actions. They are mostly considered to be the manifestation of the civil protest against illegal actions of the Israeli government or human rights violations against Palestinians. It's not being seen as a kind of a larger plan directed against Israel and the very existence of the state of Israel. And of course, not every act that is being labeled as BDS can be or should be considered as anti-Semitic. It's obvious from the human rights law perspective that there is this potential of anti-Semitism in every act of this kind. Then in legal terms, it doesn't look that easy, that simple. So we always have to deal with every singular example of BDS action. But on the political level, I think that noticing this anti-Semitic motivation and this motivation concerning the very existence of the state of Israel behind the BDS is crucially important also for national legislators to introduce the measures, legal measures, to protect their Jewish citizens, not only Jewish citizens, against BDS consequences. And I think that we should actually start with building this political awareness of politicians and other actors in member states of what BDS actually is, and also to indicate on the issues concerning human rights violations that arise from the implementation of BDS actions. But on the level of the courts, etc., it still needs to be examined case by case, I would say.
Great, thank you. Just being cognizant of the time, I think that we'll leave that as the last question. But I do want to thank you, Alexandra, for taking the time to spend this afternoon with us. I know what the time difference is later for you in Poland, but we do appreciate the time, sharing your research and your comments this afternoon, which are very thorough and very important about the situation in Europe. And I hope we can invite you to come back to share more activities, and especially obviously court cases that you're involved in that are relevant to the space. So we can follow up at a later time. Also, I want to thank everybody this afternoon for joining us and for taking the time to be with us as always. Please be alert for more upcoming webinars. Also, I want to thank Alex Jaffe, as always, for joining me to moderate the conversation. And I hope everybody's staying safe and healthy. And I wish everybody a good day. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you so very much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.